Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
The destiny of nations depends on how they nourish themselves. This is from the 18th century pundit, the highly literate and opinionated food lover, Dr. Brillat Savarin. And the idea is still alive and well today. Take Sam Chappell Sokol. Now, his main interest is the nexus of food and diplomacy and how they can be combined, in short, to change the world. He calls this tool culinary diplomacy, and he recently talked with Rebecca Shear in Washington, D.C.
Sam Chappell Sokol, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you so much, Rebecca. It's good to be here.
What is culinary diplomacy?
So I've defined culinary diplomacy in a couple of pieces that I've written as the use of food and cuisine as an instrument to create cross-cultural understanding in the hopes of improving interactions and cooperation. That's kind of an academic way of saying it's using food to get along with people and to talk with people and to get to know them better.
But it's more than just being a good cook, right? There's a lot more involved.
It's more than being a good cook. It's being a good eater, a good host, a good guest. It's kind of using food as the kind of convener. So it's, you know, it's really what happens at that table with the people around. There's a really good word for this. It's commensality, which comes from the Latin com, which means with, and mensa, which means table. So it's sitting at the table with someone, and that's kind of what defines or underlies this field of culinary diplomacy.
So if you look at the current uses of culinary diplomacy going on around the world, what, for example, has been happening with, you mentioned in one of your papers, the government of Thailand?
Yeah, so the government of Thailand has been the most active and was the kind of the first government to really use food as a tool of diplomacy. It started about 10 years ago. Thai Kitchen to the World was a project to kind of advocate for Thai cuisine worldwide. So Thai chefs were sent worldwide to kind of propagate Thai restaurants. So in the past 10 years, they've been kind of sprouting up worldwide. I have friends who've seen them in Iceland and in Nigeria. It's like this is all planned by the government so that more and more people worldwide know what Thailand is and what Thai cuisine is.
And then we have the kimchi diplomacy of South Korea. Is that the same kind of thing?
It's a similar idea, yeah. So Korea has also spent money. The government of South Korea has spent money to kind of advertise Korean food worldwide. They've started a kimchi institute in the south of the country. They've kind of been lobbying certain cooking institutions like the CIA to actually start a Korean food program along with the traditional French, Italian cuisines.
Well, here in the United States, we've definitely been practicing culinary diplomacy on an official level. In 2011, we got our first culinary ambassador, which was D.C. area chef Jose Andres. But I understand a lot has happened since then. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so Jose was the first kind of nominated to be a culinary ambassador, and he was ambassador to the Alliance for Clean Cookstoves. It was a kind of a research project to create a cookstove that could be used worldwide that wouldn't pollute the air. But since then, after Jose, the State Department launched their own Culinary Diplomacy Partnership Initiative, and that was launched in September 2012 to name about 80 chefs to an American Chef Corps. And the goal of that Chef Corps was to kind of advertise and promote American food abroad as a tool of American public diplomacy. So the way the program works is when one of these chefs is taking a trip abroad, there's kind of a target of opportunity approach. The embassy abroad will link up with the chef and will plan a program for the day. For example, Duff Goldman, the Charm City Cakes guy from Baltimore, went to Algeria and kind of hosted a pastry chef challenge in Algeria. Or D.C. and Chicago chef Art Smith went to both Israel and the West Bank in Palestine to kind of learn something about the food of that area as well as teach what he knows. So it's kind of a tool of outreach as well as learning for our own chefs. There have been about 15 trips taken in the first year of the program, which has been exponentially higher than anybody could have expected. And the program is amazing. It's completely unfunded. These chefs take the trips themselves, or the embassies abroad use speaker fees to bring chefs abroad. So the State Department's not spending a dime on this program, and it's doing exactly the things that the State Department should be doing, which is promoting, you know, it's an American public diplomacy tool.
But now culinary diplomacy doesn't just have to happen abroad.
Not at all. So there's also programs teaching Americans about foods abroad. One of my favorite concepts is the Conflict Kitchen, which is based in Pittsburgh and has also moved to Oakland. It's a takeout restaurant that only serves food from countries with which the United States is in conflict. So they focused on Afghanistan, Iran, Cuba, and Venezuela. So along with your arepa or your cubide, the wrapper of that dish has kind of facts and information about the people, about the country, and about the conflict to teach Americans what's really going on in the world through food.
A classic example of culinary diplomacy here in the United States would be the state dinner. And you've written about the state dinner and what the key to a successful state dinner is in terms of practicing culinary diplomacy. Can you describe that?
As far as I understand, I've spoken with the executive chef at the White House, Christetta Comerford, and she kind of gave me some insight about what she thinks about when she's planning a state dinner. And that's, you know, you want to represent American cuisine as the American chef should, while still making a nod or still making a suggestion of who you're hosting and the cuisine of the visiting head of state. So if we were hosting the Emperor of Japan, for instance, we might make an American mashed potato, but we would infuse it with something like wasabi. I know that's a very simplistic example, but it's the kind of thing that these chefs think about and they do a lot of research.
So now that we have a strong sense of what culinary diplomacy is, how would you respond to someone who says, you know, this is something just for the elite. This has nothing to do with everyday folk.
Well, we talked about the state dinner, and of course that's something for the elite, but we all kind of engage in culinary diplomacy every day, not even thinking about it. It's, you know, what's for dinner tonight? It's going to be Italian. It's going to be Thai. It's going to be Chinese. You know, there are historical reasons that there are all these populations in the United States were this quote-unquote melting pot. And many different populations have come and settled here, and that's how we learn about the rest of the world. It's, you know, my first experience with another country is probably through its restaurant. A great example of that is in the D.C. area, we have a very large Ethiopian population, and many D.C. residents might not know as much as they could about the country of Ethiopia, but I'm sure they've been to a restaurant because if they go on U Street, you know, there's so much good food there, and that's kind of the entree into learning more, and that's, you know, that's not happening at the elite level. That's going out to dinner on a Tuesday night.
Well, Sam Chappell-Sokol, thank you so much.
Of course. Thank you so much, Rebecca.
Sam Chappell-Sokol researches and blogs about food and conflict. Rebecca Shear is the host of Metro Connection at WAMU in Washington, D.C.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.